It's not about what boat you're in. It's who can figure out the fish. That's what this is about.
Time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
What I want to talk about today, and this is coming in, I'm in upstate New York, and our bass season opens June 15th. That's when our tournament season starts. Up until then, unless you do paper tournaments, you cannot possess them. You cannot have them in a live well, and most clubs do the live weigh-ins and then immediately release the fish. So that's coming right up in a few weeks, and I've been wanting to do an episode on tournaments and tournament prep and stuff like that. And I've been getting comments from people through Instagram and just saying, hey, I do tournaments. I'd be interested in hearing a podcast about tournaments, you know, different things like do's and don'ts, etiquette, anything you want to throw out there. So to give a little background, I bought my very first bass boat. It was a 1989 brand new Bass Tracker Pro 17 aluminum bass boat with a 40 horse outboard on it. And I thought I was big stuff. The problem was I'd always wanted a bass boat. I never allowed myself to get one until I built a place to store it so it wouldn't be outside all the time. I built a garage and put the boat in it. And like I said, I thought I was big stuff. I was ready to take on the world. The problem was, before I even got used to the boat, I dove in way over my head right into tournaments right out of the gate the first year I had that boat. And I think I bought that boat in April, and in June I was fishing tournaments on Lake Champlain, Hudson River, all lakes I'd never even been to or seen in my life. Here's the problem with that. I'd been keeping a journal I bought it in the spring of 1990 as a leftover. I saved money. So I'd been keeping a journal for 5 years, and my numbers were getting higher and higher. And I was thinking at the time, hey, I'm pretty good. But I was still so much in the learning process of what I was doing with bass fishing. I knew my numbers were really, really good, but what I never took into consideration is that those numbers were really good on the bodies of water I knew like the back of my hand, because they were small ponds and lake around my house where I lived, and just I fished them all the time. I'd never been on the Hudson River, never been to Lake Champlain. I'd fished Saratoga Lake a couple times from a rowboat. All right, I'm going to these bodies of water, Great Sacandaga Lake, Scroon Lake, all these places, Oneida Lake. I'd never seen these bodies of water. Now I'm in a huge club, 150 boat fields, and here's this young guy out there with a brand new shiny aluminum bass boat thinking he's the biggest thing in the world. And it took me a while to realize, holy cow, these guys know their stuff. I would catch fish every tournament. Oh, I'd catch pickerel. I'd catch perch. Catch
everything, but the bass. Bluegill.
These were bass tournaments, for crying out loud. Finally, I think our third or fourth tournament, it was on the Mohawk River. We caught two little keepers, and we thought, oh, we got this. We got this. You know, we caught them today. I bet it was tough for everybody. No such luck. You know, winners had a 15-pound bag. So many people caught limits. We were mired down in like 80th place, and we thought, because we had fish, we were in, you know. It was way too much, way too soon. So people are looking for information, advice, insight. Here's my insight on that. Don't do what I did. You get a boat, you want to get into bass tournaments, you're itching to do that. Get to know your boat and your equipment first. It's hard to wait. That was my problem. I just couldn't wait to get out there. Now that I got this boat, I can do this. I can compete. But I had no experience on the bodies of water these tournaments were held on, and these, you know, big 150 boat fields. All I did for the first 5 years was pay other people very good money to fish against me. I never made a cent. I just spent a lot of money in entry fees, gas, motels, meals. And loved every minute of it because I entered every single tournament believing I could and was going to win.
Well, that's a good attitude to have. But what was, just out of curiosity, what was the average cost of a tournament weekend? Like, how much did you spend a weekend?
All right, back then, let's see, going back to, well, I mean, we started fishing them in 1990, the year I bought the boat. I think on an average tournament where we had to go, and this is, I mean, we're talking back 30, 35 years almost, going out to do one tournament. Say we're doing Lake Champlain or even Saratoga Lake. We're driving out there, two of us. We're going out a day early to learn as much as we can about this big fishery, stay in the motel, eat our meals, do the tournament the next day with entry fees and all that, and then gas for their trip back. All told, probably dropping between $400 or $500, you know, in a couple days. And at doing it, I think that club had six events across the season because they were big events. They had an equipment trailer they hauled out to the site. It was a pretty big circuit. It was USA circuit.
So we'll say $500 for a weekend. Fair?
Yeah. And guys that were winning those were pocketing thousands. And I donated to those purses for 5 years.
Okay. So the equivalent in 2024 of spending $500.
Okay, yeah, yeah, you're good at that.
Is $1,199.50.
So let that sink in, guys.
That was the equivalent of dropping $1,200 a weekend and losing. But I mean, look, there's no such thing as losing because you were learning, you were having fun.
Oh yeah.
You were having your own experience. Hey man, if you had it, go spend it.
I got immersed in the culture. I'd been watching the tournaments on TV for all those years. And I remember the very first one we did, we hauled that boat all the way up to Lake Champlain, got a motel. And I mean, the town, everywhere you looked, there was bass boats on trailers and rigs and trucks. And I remember distinctly calling my wife that Friday night, the tournament the next day, you know, well, how did you do? Did you find fish? I didn't even talk about that. I was like, everywhere you look, there's bass boats of truth. This is awesome. You know, I was so caught up in the culture of it. And just that I was a part of this, you know, I just wanted to do tournaments so bad. And the thing is, I dove in way over my head. So my advice to people out there looking to get into tournaments, start small, work your way up, join a club that has, you know, like a 25 boat field or a 30 boat field or something like that. Those clubs are all over the place. Dude, there's so many clubs that get 8 or 10 boats out for a tournament. They're small clubs. That's where you want to start because you're going to make some great friendships. And if they're draw for, you know, if it's a partner's trail or if it's a draw trail, you're going to be fishing with, if it's a draw trail, you're going to be fishing with different people and learning from different people all the time. And there's a lot of advantages to that. And if you start small, you can take small steps. I jumped in so far over my head, and I did that for 5 years, paying people really good money to fish against me. Never made a cent. We did make the championship 1 year. We did well in a tournament on Saratoga Lake, where we finished 17th out of 147. In 5 years, one good finish. We didn't make any money, but it was the last three spots were merchandise and tackle packs. And we got about $50 worth of tackle. And that was a big deal. We finally accomplished something. And that finish got us into the championship because the people that had, they would take the five qualifiers from each tournament. But the people who finished ahead of us in that had already qualified. We were the third ones in, and they took the two that finished below us because they were the guys that typically did well and were already qualified. So we got into the championship. It was a 2-day event. We didn't get a limit either day, but we were like one fish short of a limit each day, and we didn't accomplish anything in the championship, but we made a championship. After 5 years, we made the year-ending championship. And at that point, I said, you know, I've been doing this 5 years. We got one prize. Hey, yay, good for us. I knew that I needed to get more well-rounded, that I just didn't have enough in my arsenal, my bag of tricks, to compete against guys that had been doing it for 25, 30 years and knew those lakes like the back of their hand. And I had talked about this in the very beginning when we did our part one and two on how we got here, that I took 3 years off to study and concentrate on three different techniques. I spent a year with the Carolina rig and a year with crankbaits and a year with a jigging pig. And I got those techniques really solid and under my belt. And after 3 years, I joined a smaller club and only did one or two events out of the year because I was working 6 days a week. But I did a company tournament. I had a brother-in-law who worked for a company in Saratoga, and they did a company tournament. But it got so big, each boat had to have one guy that worked in the company, or two, it was two people per boat. They could both work for the company, or you could have one employee, and they could have somebody with them. So my brother-in-law, who did not fish, knew that I did. And we fished that company tournament. It got so big, they had to hold it 2 weekends in a row because they lost so many employees from the company. It cut way into their production. So they actually had to hold it in two parts.
So did you win?
And we did that for 3 years. And that was the first tournament I entered after working on those techniques. And we won. And we said, we won. My brother-in-law fished that with me 3 years in a row. He never caught a fish in 3 years. So I had a blast. And the funny thing about the second year, at that point, I had graduated to my first nitro, and it was only a 17-foot entry-level nitro with a 115 Johnson outboard on the back. And if you said 115 really fast, it sounded like 150. So I did that a lot, but nice. It was a nice boat. It buzz out about 52 miles an hour was the top speed. We pull into the ramp, and there was a couple guys there with a small, like a 16-foot aluminum boat with like a 10-horse outboard, and they were mixing fuel for the tank. And I heard one guy say under his breath, "Great, here we are mixing fuel," and this guy pulls in with a nitro. And I got out of my truck, and I walked right over to that guy, and I said, "Hey, it doesn't matter what boat you have. Fish don't know who's throwing at them. It's not about what boat you're in. It's who can figure out the fish. That's what this is about. This is not a big lake. You can get into spots I can't. You have an advantage over me because my boat's too big for some of these spots." And I thought that appeased him, but I ended up winning the tournament. So he's like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah."
So what was it, just real fast, what do you think the reason was that your brother-in-law caught no fish?
He's not a fisherman. That was probably the only time all year he fished.
Oh,
he just thought, "Hey, it's a day off work and I get to do something different." He packed himself a picnic lunch. He just enjoyed being on the boat,
right,
looking around. He didn't fish as much as I did. Back in those days, I wouldn't drink. I wouldn't eat. I was like, everything's about the next cast, next cast, next cast. And he was sitting in the back of the boat with his legs crossed, having a sandwich, humming to himself, and every once in a while he'd make a cast. He's not a fisherman, but he could run a net, so that came in handy. Caught lunker and had the heaviest weight. And so the tournament director came up to me and said, "We want as many people to get prizes as possible, so do you want the trophy for first place weight or the trophy for lunker of the tournament?" And I looked at him, I said, "I got both." He goes, "Right, but we want to give one to somebody else."
Oh, come on.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. But I said,
"Are you kidding me?
I'll take the win. Give them the lunker." He says, "Okay, thanks."
Yeah, give them they were looking out for the emotional. They're looking out for the emotional states of all their employees. They're like, "Listen, Roy, we love you, but you can't win the whole thing. It's not allowed."
So my advice is, if you're going to get into tournaments and you're just dying to do it, seriously, do yourself a favor. Start small. Don't bury yourself like I did. And make sure you have a bunch of techniques in your arsenal so you can compete against these other guys. Because whatever group you get involved with, there's going to be guys there that have been doing it for eons, and they know every body of water they fish really, really well and how to get those fish. So it'll be a learning process, but I've seen guys that came in brand new and did extremely well.
Now, question. When you got out to these places where you didn't know, were you doing, like, do they have, like, the scout day when you can get out ahead of time and go ride around and you can plot stuff out?
Every club's got their own set of rules. And, like, in the club I fish, we can pre-fish, but not the day before tournament. Some of the bigger circuits, there's an off-limits period for weeks and weeks prior to the tournament date. Some clubs have no restrictions. You can fish the day before. The championship in our club, they don't want anybody on the body of water for the championship the week prior.
So one other question I have regarding tournaments, and this is a good buddy of mine had mentioned to me one time that he felt, well, not a good buddy, but buddy enough, I was on his boat, and he said that he didn't like tournament fishing. He wouldn't do it, even though he had this beautiful bass boat. He wouldn't do it because he said that after weigh-in, when you put bass back in the water and you had caught them 2 miles away from where you're putting them back in the water at like the boat launch or whatever, that it was going to affect how that bass could flourish for the rest of its life. Is there truth to that? Can relocating a bass 2 miles from where you caught it, can that mess it up, you think?
No, absolutely not. He's dead wrong. They've done tracking studies. So many times those fish will go back to where they were caught. Other times they just find better habitat. People need to realize that these fish, they know that fishery. That's their home turf. They know where the channels are, where the drop-offs are. They are way more in tune with their environment than we ever think we are. What has a more profound effect on the fish is how they're treated and handled during the time that they're held in the live well prior to weigh-in, how they're handled at weigh-in, and how they're handled afterwards. I take good care of my fish, and here's one of the biggest things I could put out there. If you're going to fish tournaments, please take to heart to this, people. We need to protect and preserve the resource if we're going to continue to enjoy it and do this. We're putting these fish in these live wells and running them all over that lake until weigh-in time. Then they're pulled out of that environment, put in a bag with some water, and held in a line until they're on the scales, unless you have holding tanks, which the bigger circuits do, which is tremendous. They're aerated. It's better for the fish. The water's kept cool, kind of somewhat sedates the fish. And then after they're weighed, and they're bouncing around, you're handed back to, and you take them to a live release boat, or we take them right back down to the ramp and immediately put them back in the water and watch, make sure they swim off. A lot of it goes to how they're handled and treated during the day. My live well, I sanitize with bleach and water after every single use, without exception. I did not used to do that. I would always rinse it and rinse it to make sure I got everything out. I wasn't getting everything out. And I credit my wife for this. She saved my fish care, so to speak. She improved my fish care. There was a time where, it was 1 year where we always had one fish dead in the live well at weigh-in. We always had one dead fish. Why am I losing one fish every time? And that happened a number of tournaments in a row. Until we did one on Great Sacandaga, we had the raw weight to win that tournament. We had the winning bag. But that day, I had three dead fish. Couldn't understand it. Our tournament has, and most tournament clubs, organizations, have rules in place where there's a dead fish penalty. In some clubs, it's 4 ounces, and in others, it's half a pound. Sometimes it's more. These are designed, you've got to keep your fish alive. They're designed to protect the resource. I had three dead fish. That was a 3/4 pound penalty. We had the tournament won. This one killed me. It burns me to this day because of my ignorance. And that's what was killing the fish. And I'll explain that. Three dead fish cost us 12 ounces. We finished sixth. That tournament paid the top five spots. Are you kidding me? We had it won.
How much money would you have paid out for a bigger tournament, what's the purse for first place usually?
All right, to use an example, Bassmaster Elite Series, 100 man field, first place, 4-day tournament, first place, $100,000.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Second place, $30,000. Not small potatoes, but
that's a lot less.
That's a $70,000 drop.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it goes to 25, 20 on down.
So you were in the thousands.
Once you hit 11th place, you're at 10,000.
It's still a nice payday. It's still a good payday. This is good money.
You're talking $55,000 in entry fees.
Yeah, but if you work at an 8-hour day, or how many days are these? These are 2-day tournaments or 1-day tournaments usually?
Those are 4-day tournaments.
4-day tournaments.
Three days of practice. You're there for a week.
I mean, $11,000 in a week? That's not bad. That's not bad at all. That's enough reason to keep doing it if you're finishing in the money.
Consider what you paid as an entry fee. Okay. Like I said, they'll have, nine events, and entry fees are like $55,000 total. So you've got a huge investment. You're paying like $6,000, $6,500, $7,500 to enter the event. You're staying in a motel or wherever you're staying for a week.
Do you have
all the gas?
Have you done these tournaments where you had to pay that kind of money to get in?
I fished a BASS national event in 1997 on Lake Champlain. It was the first year they did the Pro-Am format. Again, I'd only been doing tournaments 7 years at that point.
Right.
That was my 8th year. It was when I had just gotten back into it after doing my 3-year lessons. And I put in for that on the amateur side, got drawn. I ended up, there was 111 guys. It was the top 100 series. There was 111 competitors in that. The very first day you drew a different pro every day. I drew Brent Chapman. It was only his 3rd year on tour. He's made quite a career for himself now. But at that point, he was young, and our conversation in the boat in the morning was, yeah, I'm still trying to decide if I want to do this for a living or not. Well, he stuck with it, and he's done exceptionally well.
All right. So
second day I drew, it was his third year on tour. He'd done it for 2 years, and he was a good fisherman, and he's gotten better and better and better. He was new and young. I think he was 23 years old. I was 35 then, about. I'm not going to bother to do the math. He was still trying to figure things out. And in practice, it was overcast, or it was bright and sunny. Bright and sunny in practice. And he had done exceedingly well catching huge largemouth underneath sailboats that were moored in this one cove. Mm. But the first day of the tournament, it was overcast and threatening terrain. He went back to that same spot where all those fish were. And now, when you got bright sunny conditions, we talked about this in the previous episode, bass get underneath objects that create shade so they can see into a lit area better from a dark area. And that's why all those fish were underneath those. There was about 150 sailboats moored in this bay, and there was fish under every sailboat, for crying out loud. And he was cleaning house with 4.5-pound, 5-pound largemouth. Back in those days, if you wanted to win a tournament on Champlain, you were looking for largemouth. It's kind of flip-flop now. And you can do it with either, really. But during the tournament that first day, it was super cloudy and fish left that area. He fished it hard and spent 3/4 of the day trying to make the fish bite that weren't there anymore.
They left.
And he ended up getting a limit. I ended up with 3 for like, these were small fish, for like 4.5 pounds for 3 fish. It had me mired in 73rd place. But I got to fish with a professional. I learned a lot. The second day, I was paired with Bruce Benedict out of Forney, Texas. He was the owner of Jawtech Lure Company. He ran us all the way up. It was over an hour boat ride all the way up into the Canadian water, Missisquoi Bay. And he was throwing a spinnerbait of his own design. It was called a switchblade. You could just switch the harness on the front and change the weight of your head. It was actually a pretty unique system. And I was adding weight to my spinnerbait so I could burn it. Back then, you wanted to burn them so that the pike wouldn't get them, but the smallmouth would. He had a bay with big smallmouth, and he just didn't have any largemouth spots. Mm. So he was chasing, and they were big smallmouth up there. We ended up, I came back with a limit that was 14.5 pounds, which was good for a bag of smallmouth then. Now you better have 20. But back in those days, it was different. And that jumped me all the way up into 23rd place, and it paid the top 25.
Oh, there you go.
I was like in contention.
But
the third day, I drew Ron Shuffield, who guys listening, the younger guys listening that's now may not know who Ron Shuffield is, but they definitely know his son, Spencer, who's made a name for himself lately in the tournament world, doing very, very well. But his father, Ron Shuffield, was one of my heroes back in the day. And I couldn't believe I drew this guy. And Denny Brower and Ron Shuffield back in the 90s were the reason I wanted to learn how to throw a jigging pig, because they just dominated tournaments with that technique. And it was a big fish technique. And I'm like, I'm going to get the fish with Ron Shuffield. This is so cool. One of my heroes at that time, tremendous fisherman. And he had spots all over the lake, and he was in contention, and he, but his fish left the area, and he was lamenting, you know, this happens to me every time this year. I do really good the first 2 days. I get myself in contention, and then I lose my fish. But he said, I got some backup spots. We went and we fished a spot, a hump that he had, that we were throwing a Carolina rig, which at that point, thank goodness, I had spent a year on that technique and I knew how to do it. And I held my own. We both got a limit with a Carolina rig. And then the last 45 minutes of the day, my dream came true. He said, all right, I got a grass bed. I need a kicker fish. You need a kicker fish. We're going to go there and pitch jigs. I'm like, oh, Lord, thank you. I get to stand shoulder to shoulder with one of my heroes with a technique he's known for and do the same thing. Now, we went to this grass bed, and I'm pinching myself that I get to be in Ron Shuffield's boat with him pitching jigs into this grass bed. And I had spent a year working on this technique. I was confident with it. It was one of my go-to techniques now. And I can hold my own with this guy. I think he gets a hook set on a heavy fish powering through the grass, and no nets all year. So I just got out of the way, and I'm watching the show. He had a giant pike, toothy fish. He was upset, got the fish off, retied. Few minutes later, I get a tap. I swing, I load up. I'm like, got one, Ron. Oh, this is a big fish. He's like, probably a pike. No, it was a nice big largemouth. Had I not caught that largemouth, I still would have finished in the money, but I would have been down like near the bottom. That fish moved me with culling up. I finished 7th out of 111, and for 3 days of fishing, pocketed $1,500. My entry fee was $400.
Okay.
And I got $1,500. I doubled my income that week. Back then, I was making about, I think, working 60 hours. I think I was making $1,100 a week, but I was clearing like $700.
Mm-hmm. Taxes.
And I got a check for $1,500. I took the week off of work. I just didn't show up. Just didn't show up. I was a foreman at the time, and I told my crew, cover me. Don't say, just come in, go to work, cover me. Well, the boss found out. I got chewed out for taking a week off without permission, but I doubled my income with a fishing pole.
Did you tell him what you'd done?
He didn't care about that at all. It was all about, we got to get these buildings built. And that was his place. But he cared about it when I left the company. He's like, okay, can I get a trip in your boat?
Oh, of course.
I took him fishing one day. We still get along great.
So the pro-ams aren't as much of a thing anymore because you have to have a judge in your boat with you, right?
They switched it because some of the amateurs in the back of these boats were pretty good, and it would affect, depending on their style of fishing. They control the boat. You have the water behind the boat. They have the water in front of it. But some of these guys are just really good at picking up fish behind pros, and it started having an effect on the success that the guys in the front of the boat could have as far as covering all the water and turning around and fishing back through areas with a different technique. If you were savvy, you would use a different technique than the pro, because you're generally fishing used water. Mm-hmm. That's been gone through by a professional fish vacuum, okay, if you will. That's what I called it. I'm fishing used water behind these guys that make a living doing this. So a good tactic is to use a totally different technique and show the fish something they haven't just seen by one of the best guys in the world.
Like the flying lure.
Well, go ahead. I didn't use one.
Listen, I never tied one on that day. We were slamming them out there. Which, by the way, thank you for that photo last night. I'm still laughing this morning at the fact that the best photo that was taken of that bass, you did it on like a 2002 digital camera. Where does that even come from? Blew my mind. You're old school. You got a digital camera in your tackle box.
Well, let me tell you something. For years, I had a 35 millimeter, I don't know what they call it, Instamatic. You drop the film cartridge in it, shot the film, and sent it out to get developed. It took me years to get a digital. Now a digital is old school, but I remember about 10 years after they were out, I finally bought one, and my tournament partner, when I pulled out, he's like, look at you, digital camera?
Well, which is why I was looking at the photo. When you sent me the picture, on first glance, I didn't realize that it was a picture on a table. Like, it was a physical picture. And so I was like, what? Send me the original. What are you doing? And you're like, no, it's on my digital camera. This is a print.
I was like, oh, wow. Yeah,
who does that?
I made it my profile picture on Facebook, and, you know, it's got a vintage look to it. I appreciate that, Roy. But that was a big damn fish.
I'm vintage, okay? Sorry.
I know you're vintage. I know you are. Stuff. I know. Well, listen, obviously we're going to have to do this in two parts because we're out of time for today.
I've just barely skimmed the surface. Let me finish up talking about this live well, because I know one of the guys.
Oh, yes. We got sidetracked there.
They contacted me, Steve Smith. He does tournaments, and he's looking for any insight, can you give us any insight on techniques or etiquette or things like that? And we will get into all that with a part two of this. Shoot, this may even be a three-parter. I could talk about tournaments until I run out of air.
Let's try and keep it to two, if we can.
I want to finish up on the live well. I was killing fish because I was only rinsing my live well, and I got home. I was so upset. It still bothers me that's the win that got away. I had it won. Mm-hmm. We had it won, and we finished the first spot out of the money. Gosh darn it. Three dead fish, and I was beating myself up. I was so upset. My wife overheard me talking to myself. Why am I killing fish? Why am I killing fish? I'm trying not to do that. I said, I clean my live well after every turn. She says, what do you use to clean it with? I said, water. She said, you don't use bleach. And I just looked at her and I said, no, chemicals kill fish. And she said, well, bleach kills everything, but it evaporates completely in 24 hours. She worked in food service. They use it to sanitize. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, right over my head. I said, it does. With that doofy look at
you're a carpenter. You're not a food service guy.
Yes. Otherwise, we couldn't use it. She said, it kills everything. That's why we have to use it in food service. She said, here's what you do. Take a spray bottle, mix one part, and please, people, heed this advice. One part bleach, 10 parts water. You'll still smell the bleach, but it's absolutely strong enough to kill everything in there. I sprayed that live well and immediately rinsed it with water because I was afraid I was going to kill fish. Well, I was already doing that because of all the bacteria that had been in there for how many tournaments. Sprayed it down a second time, never scrubbed it, just sprayed it down, let it stand a little bit, and then rinsed it and rinsed it and rinsed it and rinsed it. When I backed it in my basement, I opened the live well lid so it could evaporate out. But I was down there every hour with my head inside that live well. Can I still smell bleach? Can I still smell it? And after a while, there was no trace of it. I made sure it was completely dry.
Hold on. You didn't believe your wife that it was going to evaporate and be okay. You were testing her theory downstairs with it.
Yep.
Did she get aggravated by that?
I was making sure because I had a fetish with chemicals and fish. I have a fetish about, I wear gloves when I put gas in my boat. I wear gloves when I put gas in my truck. I have a fetish about getting gas, oil, tobacco, any insect repellent, sunscreen, any unnatural scent on my hands. I feel in my head, I'm going to transfer to my rod and reel, my lures, and I don't want any of that in the water affecting how fish respond to my presentations. I have a self-admitted fetish about that. I am very skittish about any unnatural scents on my hands, so I take extreme measures to avoid that. I certainly don't want that in my live well where I'm going to be putting fish in to try to keep them alive. So to wrap this up, the very next lake we went to, I put water in my live well in that morning, and I was stunned. It looked like swimming pool water. It was crystal clear. And I stood there and I looked at that. I said, holy cow, she was right. I was killing fish because I had how many tournaments of crud and stuff in there, bacteria. As soon as you put water in it, reactivated it. And those poor fish, I have not had, that was, good grief, 17 years ago now, I have not had a single dead fish in my boat in 17 years. And I sanitize like that after every single tournament. I use a conditioner in my live well. It's one that they sell to keep bait fish alive. It does three things. It has a natural sedative, it has a natural antibiotic, and it has a calming agent so that when the fish go in that live well, it helps promote their slime coat, which is keeps them healthier. It has a natural sedative that actually calms them down when they're confined, and a natural antibiotic. So if they have anything in their system that's working against them, they come out of my live well healthier than they go in. I use ice to lower the temperature, which also sedates them somewhat, and they just come out healthier. I have not killed a fish in 17 years. Our tournament director, who does every live well check every morning on every boat of every tournament, every time he comes by and check mine, gives me the ribbon. He said, cleanest live well in the state, Roy. And I thank my wife and credit her for that, because I have not got a dead fish penalty for 17 years. And I was getting them every tournament for a year. And that was a hard learned lesson, because it cost me a win. I have one less on my resume because of my own ignorance, but God bless my wife for passing on that knowledge. I sanitize that live well religiously, and people, you will be way better ahead. We have to protect the resource, and that's a wonderful place to start. It's deplorable how many people don't do that, how bad their live wells are, but I do. I have to. It's just part of my regime every tournament.
All right.
So keep your fish healthy. Keep them alive. We will pick this up with our next installment.
Yes. So clean your live wells and send us an email if you got any questions, comments, or concerns to anglerwithinpodcast@gmail.com. And check out Roy's Instagram at all lowercase Roy Bilby.
One word, no spaces. And as always, we are here to put out as much information we can to help you tap into your angler within.